occupying the whole of Al-Quds, including eastern half, to pave the way for destruction of Masjid al-Aqsa. On October 10th, scores of Zionist squatters swarmed Al-Khalil in the occupied West Bank. They then proceeded to tear up and set fire to copies of the Noble Quran near the city's Qaytun Mosque. According to a statement issued by the Palestinian Minister of Endowments and Religious Affairs, Hatem al-Bakri, the Zionist regime troops and Zionist squatters have stormed and attacked 15 mosques since the start of the year. What precisely do they want to achieve by such criminal acts? On October 20th, the United Nations Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Al-Quds, and the Zionist regime declared the Israeli regime's occupation as illegal under international law. The three-person commission called on the General Assembly to request an urgent advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice on the legal consequences of the Israeli regime's continued refusal to end its occupation of the occupied Palestinian territory. This is an important report issued by an independent UN commission of inquiry. It will bring some comfort to the long-oppressed Palestinian people, even if it does not result in the immediate liberation of their lands. For that, they will have to intensify their struggle. There are already signs of that.
Aperture. Depleted uranium made a spectacular entrance on the battlefront in 1991. During the first Persian Gulf War, bombs and shells made with this high-density metal annihilated Saddam Hussein's tanks. And since then, the U.S. military have regarded depleted uranium munitions as the magic weapon. For those who use it, depleted uranium is beyond reproach. But others say it is a deadly poison. So who's right and who's wrong? Many countries possess weapons based on depleted uranium, and experimentation has been rife. But the consequences for civilians and the military alike have been dramatic. Today's documentary, Depleted Uranium, a Very Presentable Killer, compares and contrasts the arguments of those who defend and attack a technology that is highly toxic. Stay with us for the first part.
It's a wonderful weapon. Depleted uranium is a very dense, hard metal. And you put it on the end of a bullet or you put it on the end of a shell and it'll go through a tank and go through the second tank. I mean, it's wonderful from a military standpoint.
Based on the fact that certain armies around the world are developing new armor plating capabilities, which can't be pierced other than by depleted uranium munitions, it's quite normal to conserve a high-level operational capability that the French army envisages equipping its Leclerc tanks with this type of munitions.
I was trying to say, hey, guys, you may be creating a problem. I have been very careful not to accuse because, you know, j'accuse is a pretty strong thing to say to somebody.
My name is Jacques Charmelot. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've covered conflicts in Africa, Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and in the Balkans. And I've worked in Washington, a secret and powerful city. On July the 4th, 2012, I'm in America's federal capital. I'm in the crowd attending the Independence Day parade. But my thoughts are elsewhere. I'm back from a battleground that the American soldiers have just left, Iraq. Barack Obama has put an end to more than 20 years of war-torn confrontation between the US and this distant country. But what I saw there is indelibly etched on my memory. Depleted uranium begins in Iraq. Iraq has been subjected to more than 50 years of revolutions, dictatorships, and wars. And it's trying with all its might to be reborn. But its poisoned past weighs heavy on the fate of 30 million Iraqi citizens. My investigation begins in Basra, a huge port caught between Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. In February 1991, it is at the heart of the international offensive to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. Iraqi tanks want to leave the small emirate, but American planes, masters of guise, are waiting for them. I head for the scene of the Iraqi rout.
I took part in the war in Kuwait against the American forces.
Could you tell us about leaving Kuwait? How it happened for you?
I fought in the war up to the very end until the Iraqi army retreated, but it wasn't so much a retreat as every man for himself. The road was exposed and the planes bombarded our military forces. That was the situation with our tanks. The road was open and straight, and it was very easy for the Americans to bomb our tanks. It was this the road of death.
The final battle in the war lasted just 10 hours. Hundreds of tanks and vehicles were blown into shreds and abandoned in the desert. Much later, an official American document explains why the success was so devastating. On the road of death, American pilots used a newcomer to their weaponry arsenal. They fired thousands of rounds containing at least 320 tons of depleted uranium. The rounds are equipped with a depleted uranium arrowhead penetrator, which can pierce any armor plating. They catch fire on impact, reaching over 1,000 degrees, igniting the target and emitting a cloud of fine dust. They are real tank killers. Four countries are the main producers: the United States, Russia, China, and France. Natural uranium is used in numerous countries. Once enriched, it becomes highly radioactive and is used in atomic weapons and nuclear power stations. The residue of the enrichment process is called depleted uranium. It is weakly radioactive, but is not degradable. It has to be securely stored or recycled. 50,000 tons are produced around the world every year. In Basra, depleted uranium is accused of leaving a terrible legacy. I head for the city's central hospital.
Are you being treated?
Yes, I'm still being treated. Until God takes my soul. They diagnosed cancer in my pancreas and then my liver. You know, the countries that started the wars don't come to help us. They poured their poison on us and then they went away.
In 1991, the first Gulf War started. And at that time, I was here on a duty at night duty, when the airplanes, fighters, and bombs. After that, by many years, 3 or 4 years, we start to see many cases of cancer, particularly in this hospital. If we compare it to the 80s or 90s, We found there is an increase of, say, fourfold. 1996, somebody came here with a delegation, escorting a delegation. He's from the security, and he knows about the problem. And he told me, "Doctor, you know that we are under the effects of depleted uranium, which is used by the American." Yeah, he just whispered into my ear that we got this problem. And so we start to have a link between the use of depleted uranium and the increased cancer rates. You know, now we have what we call a cancer phobia here among people. Everybody who got a mass, they think that we got a cancer.
Even before Dr. Jawad Al-Ali learnt about the dangers of depleted uranium, in 1995, the Americans produced a film alerting its own soldiers to the risks involved with the heavy metal.
Battlefields and fighting are by nature hazardous to your health. Some hazards are easy to identify and well understood. Soldiers recognize the serious hazards presented by incoming artillery shells and bullets and take appropriate actions. However, some lesser hazards from new technological applications are not so well known and recognized. One of these newer applications is the use of depleted uranium in munitions and equipment armor.
The film fixes three safety rules for dealing with potential depleted uranium contamination. Get away as far as possible, as quickly as possible, and avoid any exposure to the skin. Three rules that were impossible to respect in Basra. I discover one of the tank cemeteries that abound throughout the city. There are thousands of tons of debris, some of which contaminated by depleted uranium dust, have been accessible to the population here for 20 years. I'll ask the head of the Environment Ministry why such dangerous metal wasn't removed to safety.
After 1991, we had a full report on the sites and their effects. There was no department to deal with it. Every time we found a piece of contaminated metal, we identified it with a red or yellow tag. Before 2003, we put a notice, "Danger, contaminated fragment, do not approach." Shortly after, we'd return to the same place and the notices would have disappeared and we'd find them somewhere else. Even if we deemed it important at the time, it was only relatively important, as the situation was very complex and local authorities had other concerns. Why did the Americans from 2003 and even since 1991 not remove or displace the metal waste? They did nothing at the time. The likely reason, in my view, is that they hadn't yet measured the effects of using this weaponry. They wanted to see the results and the effects after 5, 10, and 15 years, etc. God will decide. But the munitions they used against us will have effects on our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren for generations to come, probably until the end of time.
During the invasion of Kuwait, Paris was a faithful ally of the USA, and French troops played a crucial role. I contact journalist Marie-Claude Dubin, who was at the front line.
There was a tank which looked all burnt up. And I said, "Can I go inside? It's not mine." No, it's not mine. You can go in." I raised up clouds of dust, and I never imagined that the ashes were mixed with depleted uranium dust.
What illness are you suffering from?
An autoimmune disease. I've been told it attacks the nerves, muscles, the thyroid, plus certain neurocognitive problems, neuromuscular lesions.
To get a clearer picture of what happened to Marie-Claude Dubin and to patients in the Basra hospital, I go to Valence to see a scientist. For years, Roland Desbordes has been speaking out against the risks of depleted uranium. He's the president of CRIRAD.
We know that depleted uranium is pyrophoric, which means that it ignites spontaneously in the air, with the oxygen in the air. A flameless combustion, but with oxidization, producing uranium oxide, which is an extremely fine dust that's released into the air. You can then be contaminated internally. either through inhalation, if you're not wearing a mask, or by ingestion, because it'll be on your fingers. The uranium combines many risks, but why? Because it's an alpha emitter, and alpha radiation is what causes the most internal damage. Secondly, because it's a heavy metal, and we retain it. It metabolizes within the organism for many long years. For it to lose half its radioactivity, it takes 4.5 billion years.
4.5 billion years is the same age as planet Earth. These concerns over the harmful effects of depleted uranium dust are shared by official scientific bodies.
The problem is, in the case of internal contamination, either you ingest it because you're in a contaminated environment and it can be found in the water and in food, or you inhale and the particles of depleted uranium reach your lungs. There are two phases to this. Firstly, the uranium particles have to be dissolved to get into the blood, and once they're in the bloodstream, they'll be distributed among the various organs. Once in the organs, either it builds up or it doesn't.
We often refer to the case of the Iraqi children who play in the tanks that were destroyed and who collect the scrap metal and cut it up, or housewives who sometimes recycle the metal to make pots that they'll subsequently cook in. Do you think there's a risk?
There are potential effects, especially if there's repeated exposure, even if it's not chronic. And this will be the case. Children come to play, water is cooked in the pots. With ingestion, with repeated administration within the body, even if you only have weak doses, the fact of accumulating the various doses can ultimately have an effect on health.
Clearly, the depleted uranium dust falls down, and it settles.
Yes. Once it falls, obviously the ground will be contaminated. Afterwards, it depends on how this contamination comes about, if it's very localized or not, and whether it's in towns or in fields which will be cultivated. So there will definitely be a contamination of the environment.
Things are becoming clearer to me, and more worrying. The depleted uranium particles are dangerous for health and for nature. The career of depleted uranium munitions began in Iraq, but it continued in the heart of Europe, just a few hours by air from capital cities like Paris, Rome, Berlin. I walk among the graves in the Jewish cemetery in Sarajevo. It was from here that Serbian snipers kept the besieged city locked down. The journalists, who, like myself, came to cover the conflict, often found themselves behind the yellow walls of the Holiday Inn. In 1992, divisions in Yugoslavia forced Bosnia into a war. In April, the inhabitants of Sarajevo were trapped. The UN launched an impossible mission to reconcile Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. But the war dragged on, and in 1995, NATO intervened. NATO planes, mostly American, bombed the Serbs, who were forced to make peace. The Sniper Alley tramway takes me to Hadići, a suburb on the outskirts of Sarajevo. I enter a ruined factory, a key element in the Serbs' military industry. Tanks and cannons were repaired here. NATO planes attacked the Hadići factory seven times in September 1995. And fired more than 4,000 depleted uranium shells. When peace was reinstated, many Serbs from Hadići moved to Bratunac, a Serbian republic town in eastern Bosnia. They went there to live, and also to die. Nedeljko Zelenovic is a journalist and a witness. He has investigated the NATO bombings. His father, uncle, cousins, and dozens of friends worked in the Hadici factory.
All the workers who worked on the assembly lines at the time, who were caught in the fighting, and later at the time I was following events, they all died from various forms of cancer. In 1996, the population of Bratunac was between 20 and 22,000 people. And less than 5% of them came from Hadici. That year, in 1996, 154 people were buried in the Bratunac municipal cemetery. 3% of them came from Hadici. But in 2000, 105 people were buried in Bratunac, and 50% of them came from Hadici. I have a few names if you're interested.
Jerić Budimir, Andrić Drago, Mastilo Dušan, Banduka Milinko, Banduka Danilo, Aleksić Nenad, Makajić Simo, Stanojević Relja, Pušar Amomir, Turuntaš Ljubica, Lavušić Gospod, Udrić.
What did your son die of?
He was diagnosed with leukemia. I asked what it was caused by. And they told me it was due to depleted uranium.
Mehmed Telalovic is a Muslim. During the war, he fled Hadici, driven out by the Serbs. In 1996, he returned home, close to the ruins of the arms factory. He found his house blown apart by bombs. Mehmed rebuilt it, not suspecting that the land around it had been contaminated by poisonous dust.
We were never told. Nobody ever said anything. The public at large can't even be aware of it, as this disease is really a lottery. You put up with it, you fight it, and you might live or die. I know at least 10 people here, all young, aged between 35 and 40. They all have a cancer.
Mehmet tells me that he discovered he had colon cancer in 2004. He's taken chemotherapy and is now in remission. But the news is not good. The latest tests revealed that his prostate is 4 times bigger than normal. He has blood in his urine.
I've become fragile. Before, I could take normal showers. But now I have to have very, very hot showers. I have to wear leggings. I'm cold all the time. I'm delicate. My blood is anemic. I've no immunity.
Are you sure all this is because of the factory?
Oh, yes, I'm 100% certain. There are no other diseases here apart from cancer.
I pursue the depleted uranium trail in Italy. A great ally of the USA within NATO, the country organized humanitarian missions in Bosnia. It later sent a strong contingent to separate Serbs and Albanians in Kosovo. And it was in Italy that the dangers of depleted uranium weapons were widely exposed in late 1999. In Rome, I meet another Italian soldier who'd been sent to the Balkans, Colonel Americo Lacetti.
So it began in 1999.
I came back in 1999, and on December 24th, I had an X-ray. I remember I was alone with the technician. There was nobody at the hospital. When I asked him what I had, he said, "What have you got?" And then he said, "Enjoy Christmas, because you won't be here next year." I had this lump, 24 centimeters long, 14 centimeters wide, and 12 centimeters thick. a tumour in my lungs. After that, I had other tests, and they took a piece of the tumour and examined it. Inside were numerous ceramic particles, perfectly round. And they contained a load of substances that don't exist naturally. But they do exist when a depleted uranium projectile strikes a hard surface. This produces a cloud of dust, which when you inhale it, creates this type of pathology. I'm now living in a body that's mined.
As the death toll builds in Italy, the public is outraged, and the government has to act. On January the 3rd, 2001, the Prime Minister, Giuliano Amato, breaks the official silence and announces that he is going to demand a full account from NATO. But this demand will have little effect.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
It was quite clear from day one that Washington is not after peace in Eastern Europe and is just using Ukraine as a pawn to suppress Russia. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. In this regard, Global Times wrote, what Washington is concerned about isn't the peace of Europe and Ukraine, but how to bring down Russia using Ukraine as a pawn and taking advantage of Europe, as well as how to consolidate its hegemony in Europe and across the whole world. The international community should discard any illusions about any of the US moves which appear to promote peace. The Biden administration is privately encouraging Ukraine's leaders to signal an openness to negotiate with Russia and drop their public refusal to engage in peace talks unless Russian President Vladimir Putin is removed from power, according to people familiar with the discussions, the Washington Post reported recently. Instead of relieving or addressing the ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine, Washington's main purpose is actually to adopt a new strategy diplomatically in which Ukraine can gain more lasting support from US-European allies in its conflict with Russia. Although encouraging Kiev to engage peace talks with Russia, Washington just hopes to see a fruitless result. The U.S. intends to ensure that Ukraine holds the moral high ground amid the crisis, in a bid to obtain more continuous assistance from U.S. allies in Europe, Song Zhongping, a Chinese military expert and TV commentator, told the Global Times. Washington is to pave the way for the possible adjustment of USA to Ukraine in an attempt to prolong the ongoing conflict. Under US instigation, if Ukraine talks with Russia, the negotiations will end up as a failure, as Ukraine can use the pretext that Russia could not meet Ukraine's conditions, and then the blame of the long-standing conflict between the two countries can be passed to Russia. In this scenario, Ukraine will be regarded as the constructive side to the Ukraine crisis, while Russia, the destructive one. As a result, Ukraine will gain more firm support and aid from US-European allies. The Biden administration hopes its European allies to fill in the gap resulted from U.S. reduction, according to a Beijing-based expert who asked for anonymity. The U.S. does not want to see the military conflict between Russia and Ukraine end soon. For Russia, Ukraine, as well as Europe, the longer the crisis, the more detrimental for them. While for Washington, the longer the conflict, the more favorable position it will be in. In spite of European countries' economies and energy supply heavily hit by the ongoing crisis, they have to supply Ukraine with large amounts of military and financial aid. This is what Washington wants to achieve, exploiting Ukraine as a pawn to drag down Russia and Europe. And amid the whole process, the U.S. merely pays a light price. Meanwhile, RT wrote, Russia is discovering that its move away from the West is finding approval, even if some of the global majority may be wondering why it took so long. Military and political tensions in Europe have long been a catalyst for profound change in the structure of world politics and economics. And of course, they have often altered Russia's place in the world. While the signs of the former have been evident for at least a few years, the latter is now clearly visible. Last month's annual meeting of the Valadi International Discussion Club in Moscow clearly illustrated this trend and raised important questions. Many in Russia have long spoken of the need to move away from the Western-centric view of world, which has been inherent in our political conscientious for centuries. It is not a question of sympathies or antipathies, but of understanding changes in the world order. One cannot take a residual view of a vast part of the world where, as is now commonly said, the global majority live and where the most intensive development is taking place. No one argues against this, but it is difficult to overcome the deep-rooted tradition of evaluating our own actions through the prism of relations with the West. The events of 2022 forced this to be done in emergency mode. The West itself took the initiative. To start with the obvious, the non-Western world can be said to look sympathetically at Russia's attempt to break the system of Western domination of the international arena. Attitudes to the military operation in Ukraine ranged from understanding the reasons to regretting the humanitarian cost. But there was virtually no condemnation, much less calls for punishment for Russia challenging the West. And the reason for this is not approval of the actions in Ukraine, but precisely because the inhabitants of the former Third World consider it right and historically just to oppose former colonial overlords. In other words, the accumulated irritation with the West, in this case, manifests itself in a firm refusal to follow Western attitudes. And so it follows that an uncharted path emerges. Russia now speaks of the need for a world order in which all states are free to realize their cultural and national particularities without the standards being imposed from the outside. This idea has found enthusiastic approval. In Asia, Africa, and Latin America, the sense of injustice, which they believe permeates the entire Western-led world system, has long been at the heart of their views. That Russia has also come around to this way of thinking is welcomed, but it is perceived not as the founder of the trend, but rather as a newcomer who joined in after wandering. A And justice is not a universal concept. Its interpretation is again a product of each community's culture, especially in the international arena, where the understanding of what is right is inextricably linked to the realization of national interest. Therefore, while justice as a slogan is good and right, as a guide to action is hardly applicable in practice. More precisely, it needs to be filled with every concrete step that the interlocutor will find beneficial, opening up new opportunities. The non-Western world, however, it views NATO countries has no interest in unnecessary conflict and complications. At least for now, while the restructuring of the global structure is only gaining momentum, the advantage that the West has at its disposal is large, although it is shrinking. So is the extent of Western influence on world processes. Accordingly, the realization of ideas of justice lies first and foremost in the creation of alternatives to the previous international monopoly and the possibility of building effective ways to interact and develop not against the West, but bypassing it without its involvement. Everyone has an interest in this, and the events of 2022 have shown that such a possibility exists. All the more so as the West itself, in seeking to punish Russia, has demonstrated the extent to which it is prepared to exploit its advantages. And by the way, to further speculate on the subject of justice, the furor around the Ukrainian grain deal has shown that talk about care for the weak and the poor can easily be used for special political, economic, and even military purposes.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith through action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974.
He named you Muslims before and now. This refers to Ibrahim's supplication in Surah Baqarah, and from our progeny a nation submissive to you. Quran, Surah 2, verse 128. So God is saying that He gave them this name before and also now. Why? For what reason? In order that you do what? So that the apostle may be a witness to you, and that you may be witnesses to mankind. So that the prophet will be responsible for you, and you will be responsible for mankind. So that the prophet watches over you and witnesses what you do, and so that you will watch over mankind and witness what they do. You are the leaders of humanity. You are the guides of the human race. You are responsible for leading this caravan. The leaders of caravans do not sleep. So that the apostle may be a witness to you, and that you may be witnesses to mankind. Now that this is the case, that your responsibility is heavy indeed, that you have been entrusted with a hard task by your Lord, so maintain the prayer. Do you see? There is a moral duty here. Do you think this is just a hollowed and withered belief? So maintain the prayer, give the zakat. Surah 22, verse 78.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now Recall we discussed the meaning of maintaining the prayer previously, and hold fast to God. Cleave to God in the religion of God. Seek refuge with God. Rely on God and no one else, and no other power. When all the ways are closed to you, do not despair of Allah's help, of Allah's kindness, of Allah's grace. He is your master. Allah is your Lord, your protector, your helper. The meaning of master, mawla, and mastery, wilaya, and other such terms requires a lengthy discussion. What does it mean when Allah says He is the guardian, wali, of those who believe? In the Quran, Surah 2, verse 257. When He says He is their master. Ali is the master of the faithful. The faithful should have the wilaya of Ali. What does that mean? This word, wilaya, is a very profound and meaningful term. One day we will, inshallah, discuss the meaning of this term and the way it is used in the Quran. An excellent master and an excellent helper. There are a handful of other verses at the end of Surah Anfal which restate the duties associated with faith mentioned here, such as prayer, zakat, holding fast to Allah. It also mentions some duties associated with faith from another perspective.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
When speaking about inequality and discrimination, the first country that comes to mind is the United States of America, or, as the situation goes on, the disunited States of America. In just a small example, Forbes this past spring counted up some 2,668 billionaires on its annual list of global private fortunes that run at least 10 digits. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, "Billionaires have become a truly worldwide phenomenon. Forbes this past spring counted up some 2,668 billionaires on its annual list of global private fortunes that run at least 10 digits. And now, the Credit Suisse Research Institute has just published its broader annual census of the world's super rich, an analysis that finds grand mega-million fortunes in nearly every nation. But some nations, the Credit Suisse analysis also shows, host far more of these fortunes than others. And one nation, the United States of America, sits in a wealth class all its own. The United States boasts 39.2% of the world's millionaires. China sits second at 9.9%, with Japan third at 5.4%. The contrast becomes even more striking as we step up even higher into the world of the fabulously wealthy. Some 53% of the global deep pockets worth at least $100 million call the United States of America home. What explains this overwhelming U.S. dominance within the ranks of the world's super rich? The release of another new annual set of stats from the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. points to one prime piece of answer: corporate executive compensation. The Economic Policy Institute has emerged over recent years as America's most perceptive source of CEO pay data. An analyst from the Institute earlier this week released their latest yearly update. The headline stat from this new EPI analysis says corporate chiefs at the 350 top American firms that trade on the stock market last year realized an average $27.8 million in compensation, an 11.1% increase over their previous year's pay, and a record 399 times more than the take-home of typical American workers. Some context can help here. Back in 1965, top U.S. CEOs averaged just 20 times more than the annual compensation of typical American workers. In 1989, a quarter century later, that gap was still only running 59 to 1. The gap since then has multiplied nearly sevenfold. Overall, U.S. CEO compensation has increased 1,460% since 1978, adjusting for inflation. The pay increase for typical U.S. workers over that same time span, just 18%. Rising corporate executive compensation, note EPI's Josh Bivens and Jory Kondra, has fueled the growth of top 1% and top 0.1% incomes, leaving fewer of the gains of economic growth for ordinary workers and widening the gap between the very high earners and the bottom 90%. This increase in U.S. executives' pay has extended far beyond CEO suits. All top corporate officers have feasted in the fabulous windfall. Amazon, for instance, last year generously shared the wealth well beyond the chief executive level. Amazon CEO Andrew Jassy ended the year up $212.7 million. But Amazon's web services chief Adam Selipsy had no reason to complain either. His compensation for the year, $81.4 million. David Clark, Amazon's worldwide consumer chief, enjoyed a lucrative year as well. His pay totaled $56 million. Amazon's most typical warehouse workers, meanwhile, took home $31,705 last year. The pay gap between U.S. corporate excess and workers gives no sign of shrinking anytime soon. And that shouldn't surprise us. Corporate executives sit on each other's boards of directors. These executives have little incentive to rein in CEO pay in hard economic times and every incentive to insist that only continued high executive pay can keep in place the quality leadership that hard times so dramatically demand. Just how much does all U.S. current corporate executive compensation contribute to the wealth of America's wealthiest? Quite a bit. Between 1978 and 2020, the latest year with comparable stats available, the overall inflation-adjusted annual earnings of nation's top 0.1% jumped 385%. CEO compensation during those same years, EPI notes, grew nearly four times as fast. The bottom line, America's distribution of income and wealth will remain ridiculously top-heavy until people start limiting the rewards, continuing to rush and gush into U.S. corporate executive suits. That limit could come in any one of several different forms. Let's start with taxes. In the two decades after the Second World War, individual income over $200,000 faced a federal income tax rate that annually hovered around 90%. That tax pressure served to deflate executive compensation. Why bother skimming for outrageously high executive pay after all, when Uncle Sam stood ready to tax away most of any windfall? Another approach to corporate pay reform, limiting the gap between executive and worker compensation, has been a steadily gaining momentum over the past decade. San Francisco and Oregon's Portland now levy higher tax rates on executive pay that runs over 100 times worker pay. At the state level, legislative proposals along the same line are gaining ground. Nationally, as inequality.org details, progressive lawmakers are working to link federal government contracting and subsidies to CEO worker pay differentials. Their goal, denying federal dollars to corporations with wide pay gaps between executives and workers. Corporate America's continuing failure to limit those gaps plays out dramatically in the latest Credit Suisse Research Institute annual comprehensive stats on national mean and median individual wealth. One example, the United States last year averaged just over $579,000 in wealth per adult, almost double France's $322,000 average. But the most typical, the median French adult, held a net worth of just under $140,000, almost $50,000 more than the wealth of the most typical U.S. adult. And on the U.S. rampant inequality and discrimination, Global Times wrote, according to the Native American Rights Fund, Native American voters face 11 common barriers to political participation, including limited government services and a lack of funding for elections. Canada shocked the world with the discovery of alarming numbers of children's remains and unmarked Aboriginal burials at the site of boarding school. The incarceration rate of Indigenous Australian people is 15 times higher than that of non-Indigenous Australians, and the death rate in detention is on the rise, causing family separation and seriously undermining the development of Indigenous communities. What's more, the U.S. systematic discrimination and inequality faced by Indigenous people has not been improved by the implementation of post-pandemic economic and social recovery plans. American Indians and Alaska Natives have long had far higher unemployment rates than other ethnic groups, and the gap has widened during the post-pandemic economic recovery period. According to the recent review conclusions of the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, Indigenous people's food security and women's rights are not guaranteed, and the willingness and measures of the United States of America to fulfill its commitment to the protection of Indigenous people's rights are seriously insufficient. It is noted that the welfare of indigenous children in the U.S. is still not effectively protected, and violence and crimes against indigenous women and girls are still rampant, which greatly hinders the recovery of indigenous communities from the harm caused by the pandemic.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Walthamstow, a town in East London, home to more than 150,000 people and the longest outdoor market in Europe.
It also happens to be one of the poorest areas, where a national cost of living crisis is pushing more and more people to the brink. And less money in people's pockets has meant less business for the shops and stalls here.
Couple that with soaring utility bills and increased prices that make running a successful business a real challenge.
My weekly sale is like half and half now, this time especially. For example, I'm earning about a weekly 1,000. For example, it's go 5. It's half and half now. And the people are scary. They don't spend much. They are very choosy now.
Quiet, very quiet. We see the market empty. Because we have people, but like pass, just on the pass. Nobody do shop because they don't have money. But rent now high. But energy right now very, very high, gas high, and because that expensive right now.
The cost of living crisis has fed into the housing market as well, forcing Anne, who works in a coffee shop, to move house.
A couple months ago, I was living in a house share, but the landlord got really, like, worried about the cost of living, and he, like, tried so hard to, like, increase the prices little by little, and we ended up, like, having an argument about it. And he ended up, like, evicting me because, like, I didn't think it was fair, but he was forcing us to do stuff. So now, like, I'm paying, like, a really high price for, like, such a small room, no, like, living room or anything.
More than 6,000 people in this area claim universal credit. Recent surveys have found that nearly half of the children here live in poverty. Desperate parents and households are having to rely on charities such as this one to get by. We were told the Rukhsana Khan Foundation Food Bank gives donations to an increasing 300 households every week. Inflation remains stubbornly in the double digits. The government has hinted at increased taxes and cuts to public spending. Many here and across the UK will find it even more difficult to make ends meet. Saeed Puraza, Walthamstow, East London.
A recent study published in the Indian Journal of Ophthalmology reveals that a large number of those who sustained eye injuries due to the use of pellet guns in the mainstay of Srinagar between July and November 2016 have suffered some degree of vision loss. The survey conducted on 777 eye operations during the period reveals 80% of the victims have vision limited to counting fingers. 35-year-old Arshid Ahmed, a student of arts, was hit by pellets in both eyes in October 2016. 6 years on, Arshid says his vision of higher studies diminished just like his eyesight.
Initially, I thought things might get better after the operation, but as time passed, it started to get worse. The most hurtful thing for me is that I am dependent. I feel I'm a burden. How long will my family be able to support me?
Arshid's family was more fearful than hesitant to talk, and convincing Arshid to speak to Press TV about his condition was no less than a Herculean task.
I am often confined to my room. Darkness is my future, although the government has bragged about rehabilitation and support for pellet victims. We're left to helplessness and nothing else. And speaking about my helplessness has now become a crime.
Before the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in 2019, New Delhi used shotguns for almost a decade to quell anti-India demonstrations in Indian-administered Kashmir, resulting in thousands of pellet injuries and the epidemic of vision loss in the region. Following the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, people here might be upset about many things changing in the region. However, a remarkable achievement for government forces is that not even a single pellet gun has been used in the region following a tough crackdown on protesters. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan for decades. Both lay claims to the region but rule it in parts. India regards Kashmir as an integral part of its territory.